So it's a real pleasure to be here. I really thank Chuck and the organizers for inviting me. It's funny, I usually hang around developmental biologists and geneticists, and the tone is very different in the way people kind of ask the investigator. It reminded me, there's this old joke where a biologist, a physicist, and a mathematician are riding a train in England, having come over from the States, and the biologist looks out the window and sees a black sheep and says, "All sheep are black." And then the physicist looks out and sees the same sheep and says, "Of the set of all sheep, there exists one sheep that is black." And finally, the mathematician looks out and sees the same sheep and says, "Of the set of all sheep, there is one sheep that is black on one side." So that's that. Unfortunately, I'm the biologist, so. Practical problem. I've worked on it now about 7-8 years. Don't have a satisfactory solution, but I still think it's worth soldiering on. And that is really to understand how the diversity of interneurons in the cortex is rated. And the practicality of it is, I think if we can understand how it's generated, we'll learn a lot about just how genetic programs set up rules that allow the brain to self-organize, as Matthias was talking about yesterday. It'll also very practically give us tools so that we can target perhaps not individual cell types, but the same cell types, and do experiments that have a level of rigor that you just can't get with physical manipulations. So. The title actually refers to, is there a pointer? Or do I? Yeah. Yeah. Or not. Yeah.
Well, he's soldier on.
Okay. This is just a ploy to get rid of David, actually. So a lot of what I'm going to go through, this is what the title is a story that we've done recently, which actually I will tell as kind of a database talk at the end, if I get there. Adrian encouraged me not to use too many slides, and I put in 40, and I still bet I may not get to this, but we'll see. Actually, I'd be very happy if I didn't, which means I got enough questions, because the part I'd really like to discuss is the question I started with, which is interneuron diversity, what we know and what's worth knowing, and how best to go at it. So this is kind of Cahal's version of cells in the brain, with the principal cells on the left and the interneurons on the right, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with this. And essentially, the problem we're interested in is how this diversity of cells in the cortex gets made. I'm just writing a review right now with Bernardo Rudi, who's I don't know if many of you know him, but he's really a biophysicist who's worked on potassium channels and become interested in how they impact these cells, and that's got us working together on inhibition in the cortex. And I'm going to throw a few bits from that, which we've tried gathering together something about what's presently known about the diversity of these cells, not just in the cerebral cortex, but in the rest of the telencephalon in the brain. So in the piriform cortex, hippocampus, various parts of the amygdala and striatum. And really, I think that bears on the question of this diversity and how you think about it. So I'm going to take you through a few of the review diagrams there, and I'd welcome any input about what makes sense or doesn't make sense to you. As Chuck referred to in this revolution in the cerebral cortex, the group of people who are interested in the question of cortical interneuron diversity actually were dragged by Rafa Yusta to Cahal's hometown of Pattaya about 3 years ago to discuss the diversity. And other than having the unusual experience of sitting with colleagues in a 15th century chapel and eating a lot of good Spanish food, I'm not sure we really pushed the problem as far forward as we hoped. And so I just want to, So we'll see. So In the cortex, about 80% of the cells are pyramidal cells. The remaining 20% are the interneurons. And as you're all aware, the cortex has this very stereotypic pattern of excitation, and the interneurons do various things. Gait, feed forward, feed back, and rhythm generation are all thought to be central. So when I think of the problem from a developmental point of view, I like going back to Hebb and this whole idea of a cell assembly hypothesis, and really in a kind of, from a genetics point of view, tackle the same question Mateus was asking in a way, which is how do these cells self-organize themselves into networks? And specifically, what are the rules by which various interneurons integrate into this network, and how does the genetics that occurs in the cell prior to becoming post-mitotic interface with the information this cell will gain as it integrates in the network? And what is the kind of division of duty between what this cell knows as soon as it becomes post-mitotic and what, if you'll pardon the imprecision, it learns as it integrates into the various networks? So a point I would make, this is, yeah. I'll get into that. But the excitatory cells actually are born a little bit later than the first interneurons, but they're born a lot closer, at least in the cortex, a lot closer to where they're going to end up. So the interneurons start getting born at least in a mouse, but it probably transits across various species fairly well, around embryonic day 9.5, 10, whereas the first pyramidal cells are probably born E10-ish onwards. They come from the cerebral cortex. They haven't really been studied that much, but they almost certainly are derived in the really. They come in about E14 or E15. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Larry Katz years ago had a beautiful study, which I don't think he ever followed up on, where he followed the spiny stellate cells and showed that they migrate out just like the rest of the pyramidal cells and morphologically specialize only later, and that you can't actually tell them from the pyramidal cells early on. So, this is proved to be a great boondoggle for grants, but I think there is something to it. So a lot of, you know, I just came from a Simons Foundation meeting, and this, you know, when you talk that it's this, Jim Simons is this hedge fund manager who has an incredible amount of money and one autistic child, and he's set up the Simons Foundation to tackle autism. And so what the whole effort is to look at genes that are linked to autism and look for those genes where polymorphisms in those genes increase your risk of having autism. And it is pretty imprecise, as you might say. There's a lot of statistics, a lot of analysis, and I suspect a fairly high error rate. There are a few genes where people have been successful in linking it, and disproportionately, those genes actually turn out to be genes expressed in interneurons. So the problem with screens like this, in my mind, is you find a gene which you say is linked to autism. But what you're really saying is that if you have a given polymorphism of that gene or a copy number variant, that you have increased your chances of having autism from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 1,000, 1 in 100 in the best of cases. So clearly that mutation per se is not actually changing your guaranteeing you have autism. It's just changing your chances of getting it. And what's more, if you look at what the mutations are, they're often not loss of function or gain of function or even change of function. So, you know, I puzzled for a long time of what, if anything, are these linked genes good for? And so the only thing I think they're good for, at least at present, other than providing candidates for further investigation, is that I think there's a fair probability that if a gene is truly linked to autism or schizophrenia, there's a pretty good chance that that gene is expressed in the cell type that's affected in that disease state. So following that logic, we started looking at profiling interneurons. So I'm kind of jumping ahead. For those of you who aren't familiar with development, this is a section through a mouse brain at E13. The green there, which is kind of across the whole ventral telencephalon is a transgenic where a promoter element for the DLX genes is driving EGFP for reasons that are lost in nature. DLX genes are very important for the development of cortical interneurons, and pretty much all GABAergic cells developmentally express DLX genes. So we used a trick to get interneurons in large numbers for an embryonic analysis, which was to take a transgenic where EGFP is driven by a DLX enhancer and a minimal promoter. And you can see a ton of cells ventrally have that gene on, but as you go up into the cortex, the only cells that express EGFP are the interneurons. So very simply, if you just dissociate this and select the green cells, you end up with a highly, highly enriched interneuron population, and you can go do a microarray and immediately know the genes that are enriched in interneurons. And when we did this, it was really encouraging we're only scratching the surface as a source for genes that are going to be important for understanding cortical interneuron diversity. Because when we looked at the list, literally every gene we knew about and about 150 we didn't know about were enriched in these cells. And from a disease point of view, what was striking is of the top 500 genes, 15% of them were already known to be linked to affected neurological disorders, schizophrenia, epilepsy, or autism. Yeah. Of the top 500, then that's exactly the comparison we did. So it seemed to be highly enriched. I can't swear this means anything other than it works really, really well when you write it in a grant. I suspect it does, but so the logic then becomes a weak point for diseases that affect the brain is malfunction of some sort of interneurons, and we don't really know how. So the other kind of way of getting at this, which I'll give you a snippet of, is to say, okay, what happens if you go in and directly perturb specific interneuron classes? Do the animals develop any specific symptom that suggests they have interesting functions? And I'll show you very broad deletions of the two major classes, and you'll see that the animals are abnormal. We had a discussion, Venki and a few of us last night, of, what do you really learn about a brain by knocking out individual cell types? Does that really tell you what the cell type does, or does it just tell you how the system fails? It's funny, at the time last night after two beers, it sounded like I was feeling hopeless, I guess, and I thought you didn't learn much. And then I went home and I thought, well, you can make the same argument about genes. A given gene develops in the context of the genome, and a given gene on its own doesn't mean anything. And yet we've done pretty damn well knocking out individual genes and looking for function. So I think this is a good method. So essentially the purpose of this part of it, and again, it's far from complete, is to find genes that are enriched in interneurons, to use genetics to remove those genes in conditional specific ways, so you just knock it out in the interneurons and look at how it makes the interneuron malfunction at a cellular level, a systems level, so how do the circuits change and how does the whole animal behavior change. And we've done this with a half dozen genes, and the good news is, yes, generally, as you might expect, genes that are enriched in interneurons affect their development. And from a genetics point of view, what we'd really like to do is start with the transcription factors and understand how a transcription factor expressed transiently in a progenitor zone, turned off as they become post-mitotic, as many of them are, affects how that cell is going to be parasomal targeting, its intrinsic physiological properties, and its connectivity. We certainly don't know the details, and I didn't actually include the best example. There are now a number of very clear examples where you can take a gene. The best example, if you want to look it up, I'm not going to show you the data, is a gene called NKX2.1. Turn it off in a cell literally within the last 6 hours of its mitosis. So it's dividing in the proliferative zone for 3-4 days. You remove it with a genetics trick I'll talk about a bit. just as it becomes post-mitotic, and that cell changes from one cell type to another cell type. And you don't get a hybrid phenotype, you literally get a class switching of a neuron that had one program to another program. And it really comes down to the expression of this gene over a 6-hour period. So that actually is why the question of how transient genetic expression has a permanent effect over a long period has become a central interest in the lab. Again, there is an epigenetics project, which I won't talk about, but it gives you some flavor for the genetic side of it. What I'm really going to spend my time talking about for the next at least third of the talk is the actual interneuron diversity, a little bit how it relates to the genes, but just the diversity itself. And I'd really appreciate any insights you guys have in terms of how best to think about this, because it just sitting through talks over the last few days, it's clear how most people I deal with think about it and how you guys think about it. It's a bit different. And I think that conversation could be useful. So this is really where we started and how we started the problem. We were doing developmental genetics. We were looking at the embryonic brain, and as had been known since the work of Smart and Sturrock back in the 60s and 70s, if you cut open the top of the brain and look down at the bottom of the lateral ventricle of an embryonic brain at the beginning of neurogenesis, you saw at the bottom of the lateral ventricle these bulges, these analoga, so to speak, which are in a surprisingly simplified term for anatomists called the medial, the lateral, and the caudal ganglionic eminences, which just refer to the fact that this is medial, this is lateral, and this is caudal. And the assumption for a long time was that these eminences essentially made the basal ganglia. This is in a perfect position to make the globus pallidus, LG striatum, CG amygdala. And indeed, to a great extent, each one does contribute to each of the structures you might expect it to. But as Chuck was alluding to, work by a terrific colleague of mine who was then a postdoc with John Rubinstein, Stuart Anderson, was able to show in his postdoc that these eminences also give rise to the entirety of cortical interneurons that populate the cortex. And it's actually much broader than that. In fact, these two eminences, this one actually I would question makes interneurons at all. This makes projection medium spiny cells, so the principal cells of the striatum and the amygdala. But these two guys, the medial ganglionic eminence and the caudal ganglionic eminence, make the entire diversity of interneurons throughout the telencephalon. And that's true irrespective of whether we're talking about the cortex, somatosensory, piriform, visual, hippocampus, striatum, globus pallidus, or any of the subdivisions of the amygdala. And so one of the chief puzzles in that is the diversity is absolutely enormous among the cells across there. And I will drag you through our present thought of how you might simplify that. But just thinking about how those cells differ in those areas, I think gives you kind of why I think the problem is so interesting. To give the simplest example, I think everyone who works on interneurons would agree that there is something out there called basket cells. They are create very strong parasomal inhibition. They tend to, if you patch onto them, have high firing rates, very sharp spikes when they're depolarized, and they exist in every structure in the brain. But in the striatum, they're targeting GABAergic medium spiny cells, whereas in layer 4 of the cortex, they're targeting stellate cells. One of the things which I think is both true and false is the idea that they have unitary functions. So if you think of a basket cell and read almost anything, the kind of present idea is that they're involved in feedforward inhibition. So the classic is from Barry Connors, who showed that thalamic input comes into layer 4 and splits between input to stellate cells and basket cells, and the basket cells have a feed-forward input onto the stellate cells, and so thalamic stimulation will cause firing in the basket cell and the stellate cell, and then the feed-forward inhibition will truncate the firing of the stellate cell. And so, they have very similar properties, like they're firing, they're depressing when you give them repetitive stimulus. And that turns out to be true of basket cells. Anywhere you look at them, the genetics of where they come from is identical. But how they function, for instance, there's a recent paper by Jeff Isaacson in the piriform cortex where he looks at it there, and it turns out the feedforward inhibition in piriform is mainly in layer one. A completely different interneuron population mediates it there. And if you go down into layer three, there are the basket cells, and they're mediating feedback recurrent inhibition in that layer. So while the cells are very similar, how they function depends on what circuit they're embedded into. And understanding how that matching occurs, I think, is really going to be interesting. Yeah. The genetics of how they're developed. So I'm sorry, I'm speaking imprecisely. When I think of genetics, I'm really almost always talking about developmental genetics. And what I'm saying is that I don't know this absolutely, but I certainly know that any of the genes that affect basket cell development, which are genes that are expressed during development in the proliferative zones, affect basket cell development anywhere you look. Hippocampus, cortex, amygdala. So, yeah, so if you look at, there's a number of groups. Sasha Nelson's probably done the best job of that. There's clearly lots of, a matter of fact, the kind of question of how you approach these genetic profiling falls down to, are you better off looking at the genetics of the mature cell and do the genetic fingerprinting, as Sasha would put it, or are you better off doing it developmentally? And to some extent, I think I would make a strong argument that developmentally is highly informative, not only because it allows you to understand a program that is important and long-lasting in the cell, but because when you look in the mature cell, any gene can be turned on 30 different ways. So when you look at that mature genetic program, it's very confusing because you have this profile of genes, but the expression of a given gene in any two cells doesn't tell you anything about the common genetic program. It just says there was some trick to turn the same gene on in two cells. Whereas developmentally, the expression of the same gene in two cells generally, at least if it's a transcription factor, is indicative of a program that is going to drive that cell for the rest of its life. Yeah. I mean, I think there, when you look at the properties of it, and Massimo Scanziani has done a good job, Barry Connors has done a good job, I mean, many people, including yourself, done a good job of understanding how these cells fit into various circuits. And, when you look at a basket cell, there's lots of reasons to see why this is really well suited to give fast, precise, timed information and work in something like feedforward inhibition. But I guess the point is that it's not in any way obliged to do that circuitry alone. So,
is there clear histological networks that separate
the populations? Yeah, MG and CGE. So when you look at the genes, so there's two. They were defined because they are bulges, and that's what the anatomists had to work with. And certainly the MG and CG, as is depicted here, have a clear sulcus between them, which you can see developmentally. I'm sorry, the MG and LG have a clear sulcus between them, whereas the CG kind of fuses back here and it's a little harder to see. We've done, we now know a lot more about the genes that are expressed in these areas. And there's certainly a gene, NKX2.1, I already alluded to, that is about as close to being an MG marker as you could ask for. There's a gene CUPTF2, which is rather nice CGE marker, LG. CUPTF2. These are all a variety. I mean, we could get into it, but it wouldn't. They're a variety of transcription factors with HomeoBox and VHLH. They turn on genes. That's really all you need to know. So yes, molecularly and morphologically, you can define these. I'd say the best way to define it is the way we started, which is fate mapping it. So that's familiar to developmental biologists anyways, and the idea is essentially you want to know what one of these structures do. You take an animal where there is a dominant marker, in this case alkaline phosphatase, so the, you take a mouse which every cell expresses alkaline phosphatase, scoop out the area you want, and then inject it back embryonically into a host brain, which we can do with high-resolution ultrasound. So we use ultrasound backscatter microscopy. A friend of mine, Dan Turnbull, developed this micro technique where it uses about 100 times higher frequency than you'd use in clinical ultrasound, and it gives you on the order of, you know, 100 to 200 micron resolution, which turns out to be good enough that you can do a laparotomy on a mouse, take a needle in and guide the needle into the brain and homotopically transplant tissue from a donor to a host embryo. So we did this back in 2002, where we transplanted these various tissues, didn't really have a lot of genetics at that time, and a pretty clear result came out, which was when you took the LGE and transplanted back in, you basically got what most people expected, which is medium spiny cells in the striatum and a bunch of interneurons in the olfactory bulb. But when we did the CGE and MGE, we got, in addition to what we expected, at least in this case, a bunch of amygdala cells, and the MGE, depending on when you do, you get globus pallidus. We also got a large population of cortical interneurons. So this is really what got us interested in the problem. At that time, the question of cortical interneuron diversity, and certainly when I first went to meetings and people worked on cortical interneurons, the idea was, and I still, to some extent, still think is that a lot of this diversity is kind of learned on the job, where the cells integrate and based on information there, they differentiate into different cell types. And this very clearly showed that we got interneurons from the CG and the MGE, and the types of interneurons we got at least morphologically here, but when we went on and did physiology, it's very clear at that level as well, dependent on where they came from. And so the kind of developmental biology experiment we did is to say, okay, well, that's true, but what if you took MG cells and transplant them in the wrong structure? What do you get? Oh, I guess I don't. Yeah, there we go. So if you transplant MG into CGE, they still remain MG in their diversity. And so we've done this right down to the cellular level, and this is probably the cleanest direct experimental challenge you can do to say that these cells, at the time they're born, already have a very clear idea of what category of interneurons they're going to make. To some extent, it's a bit of a false logic, because of course these cells not only were born in a certain place but ultimately ended up in the cortex in the right place. So I certainly don't rule out the idea that the cortex or the hippocampus or the amygdala is not to some extent instructive on these cells. A matter of fact, I think a lot of the differences of interneurons you see in various structures is a result of where they end up integrating. They settle into cortical layers and differentiate, or hippocampus, by about the end of the first week postnatally. Yeah, it's just a normal development. So they're very motile. They migrate very long distances. This was first showed about 15 years ago by Arturo Alvarez Buya, that these cells have this unbelievable ability to penetrate and migrate through the brain. And they'll do it up till about the end of the first week. Some recent work by Sunil Gandhi with Mike Stryker's lab has actually tried using this as a therapeutic method for extending the period of ocular dominance plasticity in the visual cortex, and they've actually been successful in pushing that out a little by doing it, and other work from both Stuart Anderson and Arnold Krikstein have been successful in trying to see if they can ameliorate seizures with this. So there's a lot of thought that these cells might have some therapeutic value, but their motility and migration is pretty much limited to that first postnatal week in their normal development. Okay, so this is where we went from using kind of developmental biology to genetics. This is a methodology we use both to genetically fate map cells as well as to manipulate cells using conditional alleles. Again, I'll go through it a little bit. I think these are very valuable tools for anyone who's interested in doing manipulations to precise cell types. So a lot of you, I'm sure, and I've already heard it, have jumped on using AAV vectors as a way of doing gain-of-function experiments. You're probably also aware that Carl Deseroth, who spoke in this course, has made these flex vectors where you can use Cre recombinase to specify where the AAVs turn on. And I think that the combination of this hybrid technique where you use Cre driver lines and viral vectors as a way of getting specificity and high expression is really a wonderful and very powerful technique. And it really would suggest that I'm sure that if you haven't tried it, you should. What I'm going to show here is how we used just straight genetics to fate map cells of different areas. So the crux of any of these is using a gene which has a specific expression pattern. I don't really want to go into the nuances of this, but for the sake of argument, even though it's not completely true, this gene OLIG2 is specific in this context for the MGE. This gene MASH1 is transgenic, it's specific for the CGE. And then what you do is you put this inducible form of the Cre recombinase, Cre ER, and make it transgenic, and then cross it to a suitable reporter line. And the way this works is the promoter drives expression of this Cre ER in an active form. If you just cross this animal and look at it in the adult, you'll have absolutely nothing labeled. You'll have achieved nothing. But if at some point during development you pulse it with tamoxifen, it transiently makes, what it does is tamoxifen binds on to this Cre and allows it to move into the nucleus and become active for about 24 hours, and it will recombine a suitable reporter. And the result is that you can do, in this case, like BRDU fate mapping, BRDU birth dating, but to a specific structure. So in this case, using this technique, we can birth date cells in the MGE or CGE very precisely by timing when we give a pulse of tamoxifen. So if you take this animal, at a certain embryonic day, give it a pulse of tamoxifen, you'll label a cohort of cells, in this case in the MGE, in an OLIG2, and you wait a day, those cells will migrate out into the cortex. If you gave it another pulse, you could label another cohort. So this is a very precise way of targeting cells. Once you've targeted them this way, you can do whatever you want. You can suppress their activity, you can induce activity, you could put in channel rhodopsin, you can remove a given gene. So essentially, this is first and foremost a tool to be able to figure out the fate of cells, but can be used with a little bit of imagination to do any sort of manipulation to those cells, either acutely or chronically. And that's, I think, a lot of the power of using these sorts of techniques lie in that. You give it either an IP injection or you force feed it to the animal. So Pierre Chambon did this where he basically, if you're interested, I'm kind of amazed this works. He took the nuclear receptor estrogen binding domain and fused it to Cre. And so the estrogen nuclear receptors, essentially their normal function is that when you see estrogen or testosterone, it binds that and then it goes nuclear and transiently turns on gene expression. And in this case, by binding it to Cre, it docks it out in the cytoplasm. It binds to the HS heat shock protein and then will be transiently activated. You can do this trick with it. A lot of people have done a lot of transcription factors. So practically, it's just a simple matter of taking tamoxifen, which the ER has been mutated so that there's nothing in the animal that will bind to it. And then you either inject the animal or force feed it. And in that 24-hour period, the Cre becomes active. So Goichi Miyoshi, who did this work, we did a whole series of fate mapping. So the basic paradigm, this is the transplant paradigm. There you can see the UBM, an injection at E13.5 and what the injection site looks like. But with the genetics, it works rather similarly, except you give a pulse of tamoxifen instead of injecting cells. And then you can come back postnatally, in this case P21, and take a slice. And then using methods you're all familiar with, do whole cell physiology, apply drugs, even do post-hoc immunocytochemistry, and really use a constellation of methods to really say what they are. So we spent a lot of time on this. We spent probably the last 8 years. And really, this is kind of the culm, you know, 4 or 5 papers and a whole lot of work. We've really categorized in the somatosensory cortex about 15 different interneuron types that either are MG or CG derived. And well, certainly, I have no doubt Henry Markram could find another 50 subcategories here. If you think of it as a giant pie, this represents about 95% of all the interneurons that anyone's ever described in the somatosensory cortex. So the good part of this is it really, I think, in a fairly definitive way, convinced us that almost all, if not all, the interneurons in the cerebral cortex, in the somatosensory anyway, come from either this structure or this structure. I'm sorry, so there's 3 different criteria for seeing these cells. So the first is immunomarkers. So if you want to divide them up instead of the by morphology, by immunomarkers, you can divide this up into 6 or 7 basic classes. So the parvalbumin, which are fast spiking basket cells, somatostatin, which for lack of a more precise term is effectively all the Martinotti type cells. So Right. Exactly. Yeah, so these were not chosen because they're logical. A matter of fact, I really wish, as we did this, for instance, you know, one of the commonalities you see here is that basket cells and Martinotti cells are MG derived. Now, if I was going to design the system, why I would put create parasomally targeting fast spiking basket cells together with axon ascending burst spiking, rebound burst spiking, dendritic targeting Martinotti cells, I have no idea. But that is how it turned out. And so why somatostatin is specific to this and non-overlapping with parvalbumin and needed in this population, I suspect there are aspects of the function of the Martinotti cell that are tied to having being somatostatin positive, but we don't know what it is. So these markers are completely opportunistic. They're ones that allow us in a non-overlapping way to target these various, to see one population in a non-overlapping way. But they are not necessarily in any logical way known to be useful in most cases. A few of them do. Mainly, so for one thing, NOS is much more, which ones contain it depend on where you look. So in the hippocampus, there's a huge NOS population. And so, if you look in the, I'd probably say 80% of these cells in the cortex have some level of NOS, though probably most prevalently the neurogliaform here, for instance, contain a lot of NOS. So there's the IV cells and neurogliaform populations in the hippocampus have it. But if you look in the somatosensory cerebral cortex, not too many. NOS it only marks about 5% of the cells in the somatosensory. So that's a good example of part of the program that is almost certainly induced based on cues in local regions. So putting it differently, because I think you raised a good point. So at least from my way of thinking about it, these divisions reflect their site of origin, to some extent their time of origin, and I like to think that there are probably somewhere around 7 or 8 cardinal genetically programmed types of interneurons that emerge from these two structures, and that the diversity you see, like NOS expression, specific afferent and efferent connectivity, many of their physiological properties, are taking those cardinal groups and reprogramming them based on their integration into the cortex. And so if I get to the end of this, I will show you how in subpopulations here, early activities, some glutamatergic, some not, are important for certain maturation properties of some but not all of these cell types. Doesn't entirely answer your question, but that's what we have. Yeah, sure. I mean, certainly, if I can go through the markers for you, you know, I'm sure you know it as well as I do. So parvalbumin, calcium buffering, calbindin marks a subpopulation of these. So there's a lot of calcium buffering proteins, presumably, to allow them to fire quickly. A lot of neuropeptides like somatostatin, VIP, CCK, calretinin. Reelin. If you know anything about reelin, you probably know it from the reelin mutant, which the mutant causes mental retardation in humans and inversion of the cerebral cortex. So again, it's a bit of a grab bag. So we're actually, one of the things that came from the genetic profiling early on is there's kind of a lock and key correspondence. For instance, CCK is expressed actually in a very broad population of interneurons transiently developmentally. We don't know exactly which ones, but we can now fade map them using some tools Josh Huang came up with. And then if you look at the CCK receptor, it's in pyramidal cells. So the guess is that there's a peptide receptor interaction there between the interneurons and the pyramidal cells that's going to be important. In some of these cases, and I'd have to go look up exactly which ones, I think somatostatin, the somatostatin receptor, for instance, it marks two different interneuron populations. I know somatostatin's there. If I recall correctly, the receptor is actually in the CGE population. So developmentally, there's a hint that a lot of these peptides are important in some of their early communications, but that's a guess. That's just based on expression. No one knows anything functionally. So to give you more generalities, which I find interesting, one of the things in terms of how someone asked, David, I think, asked how the cortex, the excitatory cells versus the inhibitory cells are made. And there seems to be a logic. I thought the rules were going to be really simple in this, and what I called it was the temporal matching hypothesis, where essentially an interneuron integrates a cortex based on having an equivalent birthday to the cells that are there when it arrives. So with the MGE, this works out rather well, that if you're born early in the MGE, you tend to be in deep layers. If you're born late, you tend to be in superficial layers. So you can imagine something as simple as the interneurons migrate into the cortex. They go in and they find a suitably mature pyramidal cell and connect it up, fill out the space. There's got to be a tiling rule, whether that's the interneuron sucks up a certain amount of synaptic space and the next one has to look for the next available space, or whether interneurons actually repulse each other is unclear. But what is clear is that interneurons in specific classes tile across the cortex rather successfully and spread out. And there's got to be a mechanism for that, which we don't understand. But you could at least based on the MG, have come up with a rule that essentially these cells are born starting at E9.5 and finishing about E15.5. They migrate into the cortex and essentially go as far as they can. And when they hit the edge of the cortex or hit an area that's completely innervated, they go to the next available area and stop. And that works pretty well for the MGA, which are kind of have a distribution like this. The other thing we can do in terms of functionality, and this is very crude, but you know, as a first pass, it's what we can do, is we can disrupt genes that are MGA specific, in this case NKX2.1, and you can see what happens to the animal. And so specific targeting of the MGA interneurons in the mouse has kind of devastating effects on its ability to move. This is somewhat complicated because there's some striatal involvement here as well. So striatal interneurons are messed up as well. The most obvious thing is these animals have seizures and a lot of dyskinesia. And so about 75% of the interneurons from the MG are in these deep layers. So more recently, we've started to be able to target the CG interneurons. And if there was a general rule, these are up in the associational areas. So one point I was going to make, and I skipped, is when you think of building the cortex, I think everyone knows that cortex is made inside out. I've never really heard anyone comment on the fact that that means that you make your output layers first, you make your input layers next, and only hook them up together with the associational layers. But if you look at the maturation of the cortex, it's absolutely clear that's the way it works. And so the MGA cells really preferentially are in here. The CGA cells preferentially are in the superficial layers. So most people look at interneurons, talk about Martinotti and basket cells, and completely ignore the neurogliaform, bituffed, bipolar, multipolar, VIP, calretin, and Reelin cells that are up here. But in fact, if you look in the superficial layers of cortex, about 60% of the interneurons up here are the CGA-derived ones. Almost, yeah, because they're up super, yeah, that's right. So I think the irony is, if you read, everyone attributes that to the role of basket cells or Martinotti cells, but if they're doing anything up there, it's almost certainly, there's certainly a lot of the CG interneurons up there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, these two are built concurrently. So the deep layers of cortex, the cortical fugal pyramidal cells, are born earlier than the cortical recipient, the stellate cells, and then only finally do you make the associational cells. And this is very much concurrently occurring in inhibitory cells and pyramidal cells. Yeah. So this is an example of a mouse where we, in this case, actually messed up the cholinergic input to the CGE cells. We have a number of other mice where we can just disrupt the CGE cells using conditional transcriptional factor knockouts. They certainly move just fine. They have some odd behaviors. So this was just, this is not a behavioral assay. This is just someone in my lab going down and noticing that this guy behaved rather oddly and repetitively, and it was the mutant. Yeah. The kind of experiment, this is really more of a teaser than actually an experiment. The idea is that we're going to get to a point where we can target specific interneurons and disrupt them, remove them, and then of course the more elegant experiment would be to target them so you can give them a drug, transiently stop one interneuron population and do whatever you want and allow those interneurons to recover. Yeah. Generally, all areas of cortex have interneurons from both populations. Visual probably gets a little more CGE. Frontal probably gets a little more MGE. but it's no absolute. And to be honest, we picked the somatosensory for a variety of reasons, mainly because it was the best studied for the interneurons, but it also happens to be happily halfway in between. So it's, it's a bit tricky, right? Because most people who've looked at the interneuron populations look at mature markers, and those vary according to area because there are local cues that change them. So the best way to ask the question you want is to do the fate mapping experiments. And it's not obvious, it doesn't jump out at you. There is some gradient, but it's not an absolute difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good eye. That was the way we did those experiments. The problem is, when we did the original CGE experiments, we just took the cells, scooped out a chunk of brain, and put it in, right? And what happens when you do that is that many of the MG cells migrate through the CGE. So that picture of CGE is actually grossly contaminated by Martinotti cells, which migrate right through the CGE on the way up. And so those layer 4 cells are mainly Martinotti cells, which are actually MG-derived. One of the things, which again, we don't understand, it's only the Martinotti cells that migrate caudally. The fast spikers migrate straight up. When you do the CGE transplants, you get virtually no fast spikers in there. So, you know, another indication, which we haven't fully worked out, is clearly, even when they're born, they have different cues that tell them where to go. That's the first time anyone's ever noticed that. I, every time I look at that, it bugs me, and no one's ever called me on it. So, good eye. Okay, so just to give you an idea how I think about it, I think that there is early genetic decisions that first take these progenitors in the subpallium, the ventral telencephalon, and instruct them to be either projection or interneurons. Am I in my last 10 minutes here? How much? Okay, that's fine. I will actually get to my line, to the real data rather than speculation. Well, no, it's data as well. So early on, one of the general rules is progenitors in the ventral brain first make projection neurons, and then they make interneurons. And that's true in the CGE, the MGE, and actually the LGE. And there's some sort of switch where, for whatever reason, these progenitors first pop out their projection cells and then move to make interneurons. And then, you know, there's this fundamental split between the interneurons that come from MG and CGE. About 70% are MG derived, about 30% are CGE derived. Let me get back to that in a minute, because I'm going to give you a global view of that. And that's true in the cortex, but that's definitely not true everywhere there's interneurons. Yeah, no, I think what you're hitting on is a really, really interesting question, which it's worth paying attention to those numbers, but let me get back to it. So in the simplest form, these are, you know, four basic types that cover most of the diversity, even though they're further diverse. And the point I would make is that these basic categories are a result of a genetic program that was set into motion before they ever became post-mitotic. And so then, of course, there's a lot more diversity. Here's just looking at firing patterns. But you know, I think the best example is the work from Peter Somogyi, and many of the Hungarians who've really, I think, now have 23 different kinds of interneurons in the hippocampus. I have to say, I'm not fond of those categorizations, because the problem is they categorize based on detailed anatomy. And so if you're going to call a bistratified cell in the hippocampus a bistratified cell based on its innervation of two hippocampal layers, you're never going to be able to compare that to a cell anywhere else, because it's based on the anatomy. So I'll show you a chart where Bernardo and I have started to try piecing together equivalence groups across areas. But I think that actually has a lot more power in terms of trying to think of what the neurons are doing in circuits than basically saying it's a unique cell because it has unique afferent and efferent connectivity, which, given that every brain area has different cell types means it's a foregone conclusion that if you're going to use that criteria, you're going to have interneurons different everywhere. So one of the things which, again, I'd love to get your input on, and we've really started looking at the role of early network activities, or at least that's what we think we're looking at, on the maturation of specific cell types. And I'm going to show you at the end of this talk evidence that neurogliaform cells versus bitufted versus multipolar cells have very different reliance on ambient activities during development for their laminar position and their morphological development. Yeah. It's the most immutable. It's the easiest to see. Everyone loves Cajal. I don't know. You know, a matter of fact, Javier DeFelipe has just sent around the world to about 60 different scientists 300 morphological shapes, and the goal of the exercise is for us to categorize them into different interneuron classes based on how they look. You know, I don't think it's terribly useful, but that's where there's a real love of it. I think it that's a psychophysics experiment. You know, why do people? Yeah. Yeah. So I really don't want to torture you with this. Here's what we know about various genes through a lot of work. We know that this cascade of genes is important for MG-derived ones, Basket and Marinotti cells. This cascade of genes is important for CG-derived cells. And really, this is just straightforward genetics. You knock the gene out, those cells are screwed up. Yeah. Yeah. So I'll give you, there's a great example, which, a matter of fact, Bernardo to this day doesn't believe it, but the evidence is compelling. So we fate mapped somatosensory cortex, and absolutely in somatosensory cortex, what we would call neurogliaform cells, late spiking, morphologically based, what are markers, they are CG derived. And so my good friend Chris McBain took all the same genetic lines we did. And there's actually no reason to think these are not the exact same starting population. Looked in the hippocampus, and it turned out the NOS positive IV and neurogliaform cells are MG derived. And the NOS negative neurogliaform are CG derived. But if you looked at them based on firing and their shape, you would have lumped them into one category. And the real evidence that he got it right was when he did a knockout that affected just MG-derived. Those NOS-positive ones were completely screwed up. The NOS-negative ones were untouched. So yeah, that's actually the best example I can think of. Yeah. Huh? Well, not the firing you get when you patch onto them and give a square pulse of current. Yes, you're right. Functionally, in the end, that the firing will. Sure. So the answer is I can think yes, probably. I mean, it's a work in progress. I mean, I think whether what one are the. The one that really surprised me was the first one, where anatomically the same type came from two different. Well, actually, I think anatomical morphology is terrible because, you know, classes I'd put together, the firing seems to be actually fairly good at guessing the genetics. Yeah.
So
My point was not to discount anatomists. I think that's telling you, you know, to me, I'm a geneticist, so everything's a phenotype, whether it's the shape, the firing, you know. Well, so this is where I want to take the semantics out of it. So what I want to do is have a developmental genetic tool which targets X interneurons. And I'm completely agnostic of whether that's one, two, or five different types. But guess what? If I use that genetic tool, I'm targeting the same group. And then I can do an experiment. And whether that, and to me, that's what where a lot of this semantics, you can argue all you want, and you'll never come up with a good answer. But the genetic tools at least give you a way to take away the ambiguity of doing the same experiment more or less twice. So
what about the chromosome?
Yeah, sure. So there's been a whole parallel analysis where, you know, this goes back to Sue McConnell's stuff in the 80s where she talked about laminar identity and challenging the laminar fates. And in the last 7-8 years, it's just been a wonderful revolution, very akin to this, in getting markers that allow you to get pyramidal cells based on whether they're callosal, cortical fugal. We don't actually have good markers for stellates, for instance. But there are absolutely parallel. And in fairness, my friends who work on pyramidal cells point out the diversity there may not be quite as great as interneurons, but there's a lot of diversity there as well. Anyway, the point I want to say about the genetics is this is our success. We can get all of them, right? This is the failure. You know, basically, so far, we can genetically target MG, which is about 70% numerically of all interneurons, versus CGE. And we can very nicely hit this population versus this population. As has already been pointed out, the logic of why these group as two different groups comes down to what genes affect them. There's not any obvious logic of why these have common origins. And one of the things which I'd really love to do, but is not trivial, is to get the lineage relationships. Is there a progenitor in here that makes a medium spiny neuron, then a basket cell, and then a Martinotti cell, for instance? For those of you who know some of the fly stuff of Chris Doe, for instance, the neuroblasts in fly go through this very beautiful sequence of events where they go hunchback, crouple, PDM, castor. You have this progenitor which goes expresses these different factors and pops out different neurons in a very precise way. And in the cortex, that sort of logic has always been really strongly influential there, where the different laminar fates are thought to work from that sort of mechanism. Whether there's lineage relationships here, I have no idea. What I do know is that removing, for instance, this gene at the very end of the lineage completely makes this lineage behave like this lineage. So if there is a lineage relationship, it's not immutable. So here. Yeah, so DLX is both. So if you get rid of DLX, you'll screw up not only all the interneurons, but all the projection cells. DLX is a little bit iffy, as you'll see. There's four DLX genes. It turns out, of the four, one DLX1 is very specific, affects this population, which I'll get to if I get to the activity stuff. So here's what I think of as the failure. You know, here's the diversity. And we have no way either to target or really understand how any one of these populations individually is done. So that is completely a black box. I have to say the genetics still argues that these basic classes are almost certainly specified before birth as a general class, but I do not understand the logic of the genetics of how individual ones are made. Okay, so this is, you know, you might ask, how do we go about getting genes that are interesting, right? And so this is what we're doing a lot of. I actually have part of my lab that's gearing up to move to Abu Dhabi. because NYU sold part of its soul to Abu Dhabi. No, we I don't even know. I'm now trying to make a prophecy because they haven't given us the money, but they've put out a grant for a huge amount of money, and a good Claude Desplein, who Rob knows, and I are trying to go to the deserts of the Middle East Peninsula of Abu Dhabi and do this sort of analysis, because they're very well set up for it. The idea is this: if you want to do there now. Okay, we'll just leave that alone. You do one genetic profile, you look at your interneurons, right? The real useful of these microarray analysis is to do a whole series of them and create a database. So, you know, Allen Brain Atlas, for instance, looked at all the genes that are expressed, and from that you can infer what genes are in different interneuron populations, at least as a first pass. We did one where we just cut out the MG and looked at it, or looked at the interneurons from this. You can look temporally using that trick I showed you with tamoxifen to get early, mid versus late MG cells. You can remove a gene like NKX2.1 and see how the genes change. You can look at CGE populations, or you can look at the cells at various points of their development. And any one of them I don't think is that valuable, but I think to figure out the diversity by cross-correlating these sets, we're really going to start getting information, and that really is what we're hoping to do. So we're somewhere around here. We have another 6 or 7 different screens we're doing, and the hope is to create one giant database where we can cross-correlate what genes we get out of each one to start making intelligent guesses about which genes are going to do what. So it's a work in progress. Okay. General rules you get out of this, I've already told you a lot of this. The MGE initially makes cells that are targeted for layers 4 to 6 deep, and then as time goes on, increasingly populates superficial layers. The CGE seems to have a different set of rules. They start making interneurons around E12 and then fairly abruptly ends around E18.5. Always, independent of when they're born, they populate superficial layers. A few go deep, but majority go superficial. So this idea of temporal matching doesn't work out here at all. So we actually did an experiment where we picked a cohort right here where they overlap and compared interneurons born here, which are predominantly deep, to ones that are predominantly superficial here, to ask how do they segregate out. And it turns out they go up to the cortex together, wait there up until birth, and then the MG ones, even with the exact same birthday, dive in and go to the deep layers, and then a few days later, the other ones go to the superficial layers. So, you know, in this case, I certainly know it here, I don't know it here. My guess is that it has nothing to do with just mutual maturation, and you're just finding who's maturing. I think they have very specific ideas of who they need to connect with, and essentially won't do it until those cells are available. So again, I think that argues, although, you know, not definitively, but does argue that these cells have a very good idea of who their appropriate partners are. Though I suspect there must be a range of them. As I say, basket cells happily will innervate medium spiny cells in the striatum, but excitatory cells in the cortex or hippocampus. So I think they have, the way I like to think of it is they have a virtual lookup table, and maybe not even that virtual. They have a set of receptors, and there's a set of cues out there, and as those cues get bound, it changes the program in the cell, and they get more and more specialized. So that's a lot of what the microarray analysis will tell us. How do those genetic changes switch? Here's the point to what you were saying, asking about, Rob. So this is from the review that Bernardo and I are doing. And on the left, we map out the ratio of excitatory principal cells versus interneurons, green versus bright red. So here in the cortex, somatosensory or piriform cortex, it's about an 80-20 ratio, similarly in hippocampus. And the basal lateral amygdala, now it's 95.5%. So even though this is actually very cortical in structure, these excitatory cells come from the cortical ventricular zone. These come from the subcortical. The ratio here is 95.5. In the striatum, it's 95.5 again, but that's projection GABAergic cells versus interneurons. And then as you look in the central and medial amygdala, it's very much like the striatum. And so these are often considered striatal-like structures, and these are cortical structures, and there's some logic there. But the ratio massively, so if you look at the olfactory bulb, as Venki does, the ratio is the other way around. You have 80% interneurons to 20% projection cells. So I think there's something very profound in how these structures are functioning with such different ratios of local and projection cells and excitatory and inhibitory cells. But, you know, again, other than noting it, where I don't think anyone's pointed that out before, we don't really understand it. And so here's the other point we've realized. This is MG versus CGE, and you can see, again, hippocampus, cortex, and somatosensory and piriform cortex have this 70% MGE to 30% CGE. Basal lateral amygdala, again, about that ratio. But then as you move into straight, yeah, matter of fact, as we did this review is when I realized this, suddenly realized that CGE interneurons don't seem to populate these three structures. And again, I don't really understand it. I think that must have to do with the guidance. But it's really very striking. These structures essentially, I think the right way to think of it is genetically they attract a certain pool of cells, and that's got to be the first fundamental step for how they wire up quite differently. Yeah. Right. So if you look at, so tangential migration, which is really what this, so people when they talk about migrating cells, talk about radial migration, like the pyramidal cells do, where they migrate directly up, or tangential, where they move, at, as the name implies, tangentially. Tangential migration is led by the dendrite. What, the thing that's leading it is ultimately going to become the dendrite, and the axon actually trails behind. That's true both of pyramidal cells and interneurons. What's surprising is the everything we know about tangential migration maps very nicely on to all the molecules we know for axonal guidance. So natrin, semaphorin, slits, all the things that affect axonal guidance affect tangential migration. And what's kind of surprising when you think about it is tangential migration, you know, it's tempting to say, oh, well, that makes sense, right? You know, one, you pin the cell down and it grows an axon out. The other one, the cell isn't pinned down, it's following it. But with tangential migration, you're led by your dendrite, and axonal guidance, you're led by your growth cone. So genetically, it's very clear that those are the molecules, that almost anything that's been described, matter of fact, Oscar Marin has done very well by showing how thalamocortical cortical guidance cues and cues for tangential migration are a completely overlapping set. Two quick points before I have 15 minutes left or not? How am I doing? Okay, good. So I will get to the activity stuff. So this is unreadable. Good. That's probably for the best. This is it really what we're trying to do is create two tables. One is the diversity of interneurons in the somatosensory cortex. So I apologize. I didn't realize this would be unreadable. This is basically basket cells, chandelier, Martinotti cells. This probably shouldn't be there. This is X94. This is a specific transgenic line that a guy named Eric Agman made that looks like Martinotti cells, but have fast spiking, very sharp fast spiking like properties. Neurogliaform and what we call LS2, these are two other prominent populations which have late spiking, so if you depolarize them, as they reach threshold, they pause before spiking, but morphologically they seem quite different and physiologically a bit different. Finally, CCK basket cells, and then these calretinin VIP bituffed cells. So certainly you could cut these up into much smaller categories, but these are the basic major categories you see in somatosensory cortex. Yeah, okay, I apologize. So this is saying origin, molecular marker, functional properties, and by that we mean what we know about physiology, either from whole cell physiology or whether they're depressing or facilitating, morphology, and diversity within class. So fast spikers, for instance, people talk about stuttering, delayed fast spiker, and so this is trying to map out the diversity in there. And yeah, so that carries on. Bernardo would shoot me if he even knew I showed you, so this is why I'm a little nervous I'm being taped. Because this is really, as I say, a work in progress. So this one, again, equally illegible, is comparing neocortex, hippocampus, paleo piriform cortex, striatum, and basolateral amygdala. We kept the central and medial amygdala out of this because virtually nothing is known there. Another thing we ended up not talking about is the globus pallidus. That's probably identical to the striatum, but no one's written anything on it that we could find. So there, for instance, basket cells, you know, fast spiking basket cells exist and have been described equivalently in all these structures. Chandelier cells have been described in neocortex, hippocampus, and paleocortex, and basolateral amygdala, but don't appear to be in the striatum, which is surprising because they certainly, the interneurons in the striatum are mainly the MG-derived. Recently, Josh Wong just got a genetic method for targeting chandelier cells, so it may turn out, got your attention, did I? Thank you. Yeah, I'll tell you about that later, which may show it's there. I haven't actually checked with them, but I will. Martinotti cells, so Martinotti OLM cells in the hippocampus, low threshold LTS cells in the striatum, cells that Jeff Isaacson and Bahar have described here, which look somatostatin, very much like the Martinotti cells elsewhere. And there's certainly a somatostatin population in the basolateral amygdala, less certain about the medial and central. X94, I mentioned. So neuroglioform, this is the one I mentioned to you, which is really, you know, we thought was CG-derived. It certainly looks to be CG-derived in cortex, but is MG and CG derived in hippocampus, and basal lateral has neurogliaform that have been described. CCK basket cells, interesting one. This again, Josh Wong, for those of you who don't know, he has done this blueprint project with Sasha Nelson over the last few years where they've made a whole ton of Cree lines that target various interneurons. And it's just been, I think a ton of labs have jumped on them. They've been incredibly useful. There's been a whole argument for those of you interested in such things between people who make back transgenics like GenSat and people who do knock-ins like Josh Wong. There's a fair bit of bad press about backs of people who claim they're unreliable. I think that's overblown. Some of them are very reliable and good, but if you want to target a population identical to the ones you see expressing a marker, then you need to knock it in. And the answer is just a simple logic thing. Genes are not just an open reading frame. They have up to a megabase of control elements that are either intronic or flanking the gene. And even in a back where you have 200 kilobases, you will not have all the control elements, or you may or may not have it. So what happens with the back is you tend to get reliable expression in a subset of the cells and miss or get atopic expression in other ones. So a back's great when it works, but will not always do it. Josh Wong has done it exclusively with knock-ins and done a wonderful job. And there've been some surprises in the CCK, this is why I brought it up, CCK Cree. He made a CCK Cree, and as I may have mentioned, there's about 5% of the cells in the somatosensory cortex have CCK. Much more abundant in the hippocampus. But if you do a CCK Cree, hippocampus looks completely normal in terms of the CCK population. So if you look at the fate map CCK Cree cells and compare it to CCK, they overlap beautifully. But then you look in the cortex and now there's a ton of CCK cells. So Josh and I have argued about whether the CCK cells, it could be either transient developmental expression of CCK, which you'd pick up with the CCK Cree, Or it could be that they're very low expressing, and so there's a lot more CCK cells in somatosensory cortex than we know. And we're currently doing the physiology to sort that out. LS2, this is this kind of late spiking. We call them dense plexus, but Bernardo doesn't like that name, so he didn't put it in. There's LS2-like cells. So this is like the neurogliaform, but morphologically and physiologically distinct. Bituffed. So these are the ones Thomas Freund talked about as targeting other interneuron populations, at least in the hippocampus. Physiologically, they're in the cortex, as well as in the basolateral amygdala. Anyway, I'll stop there because, as you can see, most of them. This is the problem I have with the Somogyi approach. You end up with all these specialized cells which don't match up to anything. And I suspect as we do the genetics better, we'll find at least what these cells do elsewhere. So there's a couple of possibilities. Bistratified, for instance, this is parvalbumin, very morphologically distinct cell, but FIRE is more like a fast spiking cell that he's seen in the hippocampus. I have no idea whether anything like it is elsewhere. So you could argue that these are made and they know to go to the hippocampus, and that's the only place they go. Alternatively, these could have equivalence groups here, which we're blind to because we have no way of knowing who's equivalent to who. And that's a little bit, I think, like you were alluding to. And I'll leave that there. Okay, so now we'll go from a lot of speculation and hand-waving to one very specific story. And that's the story of how activity affects the development of a very specific population of CG interneurons. So this is kind of like the life cycle of an interneuron from its early days of migration, arrival. So basically, the way it works is that you have, the way the cortex forms is, you know, you have proliferative cells in the ventricular zone of the cortex. They migrate through an intermediate zone and form what's called a preplate. That preplate is really composed of neurons made during primary neurogenesis, the so-called Cajal-Retzius cells that are known to secrete reelin and needed for proper cortical lamination, and the subplate cells. And they're mixed together in the cortical plate initially, and then as cells come out later to form the definitive cortical layers, they split that plate, that preplate, and kind of stuff between them, with the Cajal-Retzius cells getting pushed up and the preplates, the subplate cells ending up below it. And both the Cajal-Retzius and subplate cells are largely thought to die off, though there's certainly some evidence subplate cells persist. And so that's cortical development. And the interneurons essentially migrate up in two streams and sandwich. They either come below the cortical plate or above it in the marginal zone, that acellular region, which is just filled with GABAergic cells. So they march up in these two streams that are very, very evident, sandwich that cortical plate, and then starting at about P2, first the MG cells and then the CG cells intercalate into the cortex and ultimately form the cortical layers, right? So that's kind of, sorry? So in the deeper layers, I think that the notion that neuronal morphology is dense enough to cause an obstacle at this stage just is untrue. You know, there's certainly some morphological differentiation of the deep layers of cortex, but the cells move through them happily and apparently unimpeded. So I don't think there's a physical barrier. There could be surface molecules that are impediments. Certainly, they stabilize and settle in the deep layers first. Whether that's the best evidence on what causes them to stop migrating is a paper from Kobos and John Rubinstein, where they argued that DLX genes actually drive the program. So the DLX genes are on until they start differentiating, with one exception, this DLX1 gene, and that seems to promote single processes and suppress their differentiation of multiple processes. So there's a program I know you were talking about what's impeding them, but the cells themselves keep a very simplified morphology until they stop migrating, and then they start bursting out with dendrites and axons. So that starts occurring, you know, P0 to P7, and essentially starting deep and going superficial, they start getting synaptic connectivity. Really, if you're patching on, so we've done a lot of, it's a frustrating process trying to look at interneuron diversity in the, up to about P14, because everything looks the same. You patch onto them, they have immature properties, you can't really tell much. And then at P14, the intrinsic properties that distinguish them become very, very evident. And then, you know, this is really where I guess most of you are interested, all critical period activities that I guess in auditory start here and in visual and elsewhere probably go out to P35 or so. So in a way, this is what we're interested in, this integration process and the timing of how they go in, because our suspicion is that from here to here, they're learning an awful lot and there's a lot of information transfer as the cells settle in and go into the various layers. And so, you know, when people talk about activity in the cortex, the first thing that's described, and this is in the cortex, but it's kind of throughout the nervous system, are these slow, about 1 hertz calcium oscillations, which seem to be intrinsic. Many of them seem to be related to the gap junctions that are forming there, electrically coupled cells. Sorry? Sure. That's right. Actually, there's 3 or 4 of them, but yes, that was one of the best examples. And then starting around P0 to 7, you start seeing what Ben Ary and Rosie Kozark call SPAs, spontaneous plateau amplitudes. I apologize, I'm being generic. I'm treating cortex and hippocampus as if they're the same. Certainly those who like to think of them as the same will approve, but I mean, these are really, this was described really only so far in the hippocampus, though Rosa tells me she sees similar type activities in the cortex. And these CNOs, these cortical embryonic network oscillations, which appear here, and both of these seem to be glutamate dependent. And as these start, the calcium oscillations disappear, and then at least in the hippocampus, and there are some reports in the cortex of these giant depolarizing potentials which come in next, and again, that seems to wipe out this. So I don't know, I don't think anyone has any clear idea what these network oscillations are doing, what they're good for, or what they're important for, but our idea was, since the CGE cells are these late arriving cells that go into the superficial layers of cortex, maybe these early network activities are somehow important for their development. That was the hypothesis. And certainly, yeah, I'm gonna just, this is Takao Hench's, their familiar Mexican hat, I guess, talking about how basket cells are needed for closing of the critical period in the visual cortex. So certainly there's evidence out there that interneurons are important for the critical period, and Mike Stryker and Takao Hench's stuff has really led the way on that. But we're actually asking the opposite question. How are those activities important for the maturation of individual cells? And so this has been work of these two postdocs, Natalia DeMarco and Theo Karyanis. And so we started this off with a number of fairly crude manipulations, and I save this to the ends because if you are critical as to what exactly this is doing, I'm with you. I'm not exactly sure we're doing what we think we're doing, but certainly a lot of people have used this inward rectifying potassium channel overexpression as a way of attenuating activity. For those of you not familiar with it, its appealing property is that it's open up to about minus 40. So it's going to, it gives strong inward rectifying currents, but it gets magnesium blocked at about minus 40, so that if they do reach threshold, it shuts off and you're not actually changing the way they fire if they do fire. And so a number of people have used this to attenuate activity, and we decided we'd use it to target the CGE population. So you've seen this a bunch of times. You know, these are kind of the five simplest groups of interneurons we talk about. And what Natalia, when Natalia started this, I suggested her doing this all with very fancy genetics, and she looked at me and said that that'll take forever. So she decided she was going to use electroporation. And she used two simple tricks in order to target the CGE cells. The first was, I mentioned these DLX genes endlessly. So genomically, they're very cool. There's four DLX genes that are important for interneuron development, 1 and 2 and 5 and 6. 3 and 4 are around, but they have nothing to do with the interneurons. And they basically, in the genome, in both cases, sit tail to tail. So DLX1 goes this way and 2 goes that way, and they're separated by about 10 kilobases. And a guy named Mark Ecker sequenced that whole 10 kilobases and found that there's about a 500 base pair segment in there, which is an enhancer that is incredibly good when hooked up to a minimal promoter of driving expression in interneurons. So what Natalia realized, if she electroporated that in to the ventral brain, it would only get expressed in GABAergic cells. And then by electroporating late, that's early, you could get MGA, but she did it at E15.5, she could preferentially just target the CGE cells. So this works surprisingly well. This is showing a CAG mCherry versus a DLX1, and you can see you're not restricting your electroporation to ventral, but this construct only gets expressed in ventral cells. And using this, she was able to target with Theo essentially the three major gross populations from the CGE, and that would be the multipolar, bituffed bipolar, and neurogliaform. And for markers, essentially, this is VIP. This is actually VIP, but calretinin VIP, so we use calretinin, and this is real and positive. And so with a simple immuno, you can pretty much distinguish these three. In electroporation, for anyone who's used it, you know on a good day versus bad day, you get very different numbers. But what's encouraging is using this method, you always get, with this construct, about 30% of each one of these. Sometimes you get a lot, sometimes you get a little, but that, you know, it's reliable in ratios. So then using this KER2.1, we started to overexpress it to look at it. This is just a variety of papers that have looked at what KER2.1 does elsewhere. And so in the cortex, a number of papers have shown that if you just attenuate activity morphologically, the cells don't develop as well. But in terms of migration, they don't seem unaffected. Now, this is completely ignoring different pyramidal cell types, which are highly diverse. So I'm not entirely sure that you wouldn't see specificity if you targeted subsets. But at least so far, the idea is that activity during this window is important for morphology. Lots about synapse formation. But in terms of the morphology, it reduces it, but doesn't have any selective effect on specific types. So this just shows you it works. And so here's the first result. So if we did this at E18.5 and go up to P2, whether it is KER2.1 or not, they look absolutely identical, no obvious difference. I'll give you a more explicit test that KER2.1 overexpression doesn't, at least by our what we're looking at, have any obvious phenotype up to P2. But starting at around P3, 4, what you notice is that the cells with KER2.1 end up in deeper layers, and in fact, there's a shift of these cells to deeper layers when you've expressed KER2.1 constitutively from E15.5 all the way up. And that shift in cells turns out to be cell type specific in that the VIP cells don't have any shift in their laminar distribution, but the calretinin and the reelin ones are shifted deeper. So the bituffed ones and the reelin ones end up in deeper layers, whereas the VIP ones weren't shifted at all. I originally interpreted this, that this was causing them to migrate too far, because you kind of think of them as up here and migrating down. I think that's wrong. I think they're not migrating enough. And the reason, actually Frank Pelu, to his credit, called me on this, and then I thought about it and realized he was probably right, is that these interneurons are up above the pyramidal cells, and they come in. But you can remember the pyramidal cells are crawling up above them and stacking in above them. So if you come in and stop moving, you're going to get buried. You have to keep swimming to the surface to stay in the superficial layers. And I think these guys don't manage to do that. And we now have some experimental evidence that supports that, which I'll get to right at the end. Yeah?
I'm
So you're absolutely right. Synaptic activity in these cells. So if you go in and you record from them, you do not see depolarizations, right? During this period up to migration, you're absolutely right. You will not get, you'll get very little. You'll see some evidence of little synaptic, presynaptic events. So they're bathed in GABA, which is supposed to be excitatory, but they're not having activity in the sense of depolarizations. They're too immature for that. But it does seem to have an effect on them. Keeping, well, let's be specific. So the sheep is black on one side. Yeah. They're not spiking in either case, but their resting potential, sorry? That's right.
Or bring them, I guess, closer to the passing equilibrium.
Right. So you could say, yeah, that would be my guess. If depolarized, so you could say, well, it changes the ionic balance because they're sitting at a more depolarized potential. They certainly have, if you just hold on them, you don't see active events, but you do see some fluctuation in the membrane potential. And it does seem to be there are some sort of events that are occurring, not synaptically mediated, but there is something. So you're right, it's not activity in the conventional way till you hit P7, then you start seeing synaptic activity. So certainly the laminar phenotype I would not attribute to depolarizations per se, but I don't know. If we want to be precise, KIR2.1 expression causes laminar defects. When we started looking at the morphology in a way that matched exactly the laminar defects, the reelin, so here's an example of a neuroglioform cell, highly truncated, and the calretinin cells were highly truncated. Interestingly, these guys kind of lost axons and dendrites, whereas the calretinin ones had no effect on their dendrites, but a highly truncated axon. So again, it seemed really specific even between the types that were affected. But again, the VIP ones, multipolar ones, perhaps because they, on the whole, seem to differentiate a little bit later, didn't seem to have any effect. Impossible to ask in these. Remember, we're electroporating. We're hitting less than 1% of the cells. So, the good part about this is all cell autonomous, because any electroporated cell with KIR2.1 is surrounded by wild-type cells. But it's impossible to know any non-autonomous effects. So if we look at P15 to see, is this just delaying them or is it actually doing something? These phenotypes persist right up to P20. And the VIP ones, again, look completely normal when we do it. And this really surprised me. When we did this and looked at the intrinsic physiology, these guys don't look that bad. You can still identify the subclasses when you get out to P15 based on their intrinsic physiology, even though morphologically they're completely screwed up. And so, you know, that, to me that was really incredibly surprising because I would have thought that those intrinsic properties were innately tied to their morphology and they seem to be able to adjust. Okay, so I'm pretty much out of time. So let me, I'm gonna very quickly go through the end result. So what I've shown you so far, laminar position and morphology, is that one or two phenotypes, right? You could easily imagine they're in the wrong lamina. So of course, they're not getting the right activity, so they don't morphologically differentiate. So we use this method that Richard Axel had made this, a guy named Joseph Gogos, made a Teto animal where KIR2.1 is driven by TETO. And now in electroporation, we put in TTA. So this is tetracycline transactivator that binds here and drives KIR2.1. So this works exactly like the straight electroporation, but now you can add doxycycline and shut this off. So, and we can gauge that with LAC-Z. It's really hard to gauge it based on the physiology. So the best we could do was ask when the LAC-Z disappeared. And so we did two experiments. One was remove it, the KIR2.1 activity at P0. This is really kind of a control, because up till now we had blocked it up all the way through. So we wanted to know, even though we didn't see a phenotype here, did having this KIR2.1 have an effect here? And then we did it again at P3. This is when we already see a laminar phenotype and then asking what happens if we let it go. So this is what happens if you do a control, the KER2.1 constitutively, now they're in the wrong layer, and now if you shut it off at P0, both their laminar position and their morphology are rescued. So the KER2.1 overexpression, if you get rid of it by P0, doesn't seem to matter. This, in this case, it's looking at P8, but yes, you could look at P15. Now, if you go to P3, now they're in the wrong laminar position, but morphologically, they're normal. So you do not have to be in the right laminar position to have a normal morphology. And I'll give you another line of evidence that supports that in a minute. And so again, this is just looking at the morphologies, just basically graphing what I said to you, which was there weren't obvious, I mean, there's some differences, but really, I trust the eyeballing more than I trust the careful analysis in this. Morphologically, these look pretty normal as long as you remove the KER2.1 by P3. So what is the activity that's important for the morphological development? And this is an experiment I would absolutely hate on its own, but I like it in this context, which is literally making injections of kynurenic acid into the cortex at P0 up to P3, just kind of using this very general blocker of glutamate signaling to see what you get. And what's encouraging is it has no effect on laminar phenotype. If you go P0, P2, P3, all the way up, it has no effect at all if you do it at P0 or P1 or P2. But if you start at P3 and move onward, you get morphological defects in the reelin and the calretinin cells, but not the VIP cells. So if you block glutamate signaling, it seems to phenocopy the morphological defects you see in these populations. Absolutely. This is now absolutely. So this is just a sledgehammer on it. And it would be much better to have done like a dominant negative, GluR 1 or 2, or, you know, but we don't have the tools yet. Yeah. So this is basically the results that we got here. If you block KER2.1 constitutively, you get a migration and morphology defect in these classes. You do it to P0, you rescue everything. You block it up to P3, you get a migration defect, but a morphology is normal. You block it out here past P3 with the kynurenic acid, you get a morphology, but not a migration. You block the kynurenic acid prior to P3, you get nothing. So I'm gonna end it there. We were forced to go look for gene candidates, and we figured out a way to find a few and actually have a gene candidate that we think explains the migration. I could show you, but I think I've already imposed on your patience enough. So I'll end it there. Unless, if you want to see it, I'll show you.